Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We are back in the Billy Meyer case. Edward Albert Meyer is a one-armed farmer from Switzerland. He lives in a tiny mountain village called Hinterschmidruti, which is about an hour east of Zurich. He's the oldest spirit on the planet, according to the Meyer material. The extraterrestrials that he's had contact with since 5 years old know him as Nokodamian. And according to Contact 238, Nokodamian led his people into the oldest space-time shifted regions of the constellation of Lyra, some 26 million years ago. and they set up an empire around large planets in the Lyra and the Vega systems. Lyrians were titans by our standards. They stood 20 to 30 feet tall with fantastic technologies and fantastic conscious related abilities. Their pattern was to rise to very high levels of technology and then fight among themselves and then be pushed back into earlier times to repeat the process again. They fanned out all over our galaxy, colonizing other worlds, mixing with other people, and sometimes conquering other worlds. And the battles were usually very short and one-sided in favor of the Lyrians. Well, there is a remaining historical symbol of the conquests of these Lyrians, and it's called the Ring Nebula. And nebulas are really leftover ionizing particles from dying stars. Well, in ancient times, this star was destroyed by one of these Ishwishes, who was maybe not completely balanced in his consciousness-related abilities. And he created a symbol that lasts to this time that is a symbol for the evil that humanity is capable of. And when Billy was on his great journey in the spacer that occurred, we studied that in Contact 31, he saw what looked like a giant eye looking at him in space. And they refer to this incredible ring nebula as JHWH Mata, or the Eye of God. And it stands as a symbol to these extraterrestrial humans that if they don't adhere to the spiritual teachings, that horrifically disastrous things can take place. When Billy met his first teacher, Svath, in 1945, one of the things Svath told Billy is that we were entering into a time called the third millennium. And he warned us that during this time, our leaders would become megalomaniacal, that they would take away our rights of self-determination, and that the people would become indolent, very lazy. They would become obtuse. They would become slow learners, slow to understand. And this whole circumstances would eventually lead to ambivalence, and somehow the mixture of all this negativity would breed a kind of hostility in the third millennium. In Contact 72, it says that a time of confusion and maliciousness is about to come over our world. And we're starting to see the evidence of this confusion and maliciousness as the war has broken out in the Ukraine. Now, the Ukraine is a Texas-sized country in Eastern Europe. It's between Europe and Russia. And I think it was 1991 when the Ukraine became its own country. Well, back in March, for various reasons, the Russians have invaded Crimea, which is one of the lower peninsulas in the Ukraine. And it's created a very hostile circumstance where we have two very powerful nations with very powerful weapons that are going to war. And hopefully this will not lead to the bigger problems that are talked about in the Henoch prophecies. Let's listen to this clip by a Ukrainian protester.
It seemed a few months ago that you had won, that the man you wanted out was gone and there was celebration. How would you describe your feelings now with 40,000 troops on your eastern border?
I'm extremely worried about my country, about Ukraine, about my people. I think the same as a lot of Ukrainians. We feel betrayed because when we gave up the third biggest nuclear weapon in the world, just to keep peace in the whole world. And the country which took a commitment to protect our borders, now this country is a main aggressor. And it's really a betray because we were brotherhood countries, brotherhood nations, and now we have to fight and to fight for our, just to fight for a possibility,
right,
to stay independent. And that's very painful.
Right.
But I feel determined about that.
You must.
I feel that we will never give up because that's our country and that's our future, and we will have this prosperous future because we gave too much. These people who died on Maidan, they could never die in vain. We will do everything we can to protect our independence and to have our future as we wanted to have.
But Yulia, what about the possibilities of a civil war? We get the sense that much of the eastern half of your country loves Russia and would rather be part of Russia. Is that true? What is the real breakdown? What's the real split?
You know, there are a lot of stereotypes about Ukraine in world media, but it's better for you to talk to your underground journalists who saw everything on their eyes. Our country isn't splitted. We have we lived for 30 years, for all the years after independence, peacefully. I am from Kyiv, where most of the people are speaking Russian. We are a bilingual society. We speak two languages without any problems, and we respect nationalities. Crimean Tatars, who are the minority, they are dreaming to be a part of Ukraine. They are afraid of all this Russian persecution. And it's not we are not divided. We, all of us, we want one thing. We want to live in a safe and prosper home. It doesn't matter what language are you talking,
right,
are you speaking. It matter only thing which is matter, if you want to if you love Ukraine, if you want to be a part of Ukraine, and believe me, these people want, they, because after like I read the last statistic in New York Times, and it was written that only 6% of the people on the east of Ukraine want to be
6%.
A part of Russia.
Interesting.
6%.
6%.
6%.
Well, Yulia, we want to move on, but I have to thank you for your passion. You have values that all of our audience can relate to, and we appreciate you taking the time to articulate. I hope you'll come back.
I'm very, very grateful for your time, and I just want you to know that we are fighting, we are standing now not for only for Ukraine, but for values of freedom and human rights. Thank you for your time.
The third millennium will be a time when leaders become megalomaniacal and they will take away the rights of the people. And we've seen that here in the United States with the National Defense Authorization Act, which basically takes away all of our rights, takes away our right to an attorney, a right to a fair trial. We're seeing the erosion of our rights of free speech, the rights that we have to express our opinions and our thoughts, are slowly being eroded. Svath warned Billy that he should stay in the background because the people of the earth make for themselves idols. He was also told that he would be the target of all sorts of malicious attacks by not only those closest to him, but people that would try to kill him. His teaching will eventually lead to a time of great prosperity on the earth, but we are in the middle of the transition period where the people of the earth are indolent and obtuse, ambivalent, and about to become malicious. And we've seen the examples of that in the Ferguson riots and in the wars that are starting now in the Ukraine. You might remember that the Earth is still suffering from the telenotic impulses associated with the Giza intelligences. And remember, the Giza intelligences settled in old cubicle constructions far below the Giza Plateau. These cubicle constructions are about 72,000 years old. And in their headquarters, I've talked about many times about Billy and Asket as they went below into these old tunnel structures far below the Giza Plateau, and they eventually came to this large hallway. It was illuminated by this mysterious light that shone everywhere and yet nowhere, and they saw this great ancient spacecraft, as well as they saw guards, and they saw what appeared to be a Y-shaped cross and artifacts from the crucifixion. And Billy was told that these Giza intelligences manipulated the people of the earth through religion and through a kind of technology called telenotic impulses, which we are still suffering from today and will still affect us for two or three more centuries. Now, Asket's people are called the Timmers. The Timmers are also descendants of the Lyrians. The Timmers are about 300 years ahead of the Plearn in terms of their technology. And one of the things that Billy did when he was having his 11-year contact with Asket is time travel. And he time traveled back to the time of the great teacher Emmanuel, which is discussed in our New Testament, kind of a, according to my material, fictionalized version of the life of Emmanuel, who taught the people of that day about the universal consciousness, the creational universal consciousness that eventually got distorted into the religious notion that we have today of God. Now, the Meyer material in the book of OM, Omphal and Merado, Lyrian for the Navel of Life, says the gods of the earth were human. They came from the depths of space, and they set themselves up over the humans of earth, unrightfully so. And they created the religions of the earth, and they demanded worship. And they were not the creators of the universe. They were human beings at a higher consciousness level than the earth humans. And eventually they died off, or they wandered off and left, but seared deep into the consciousness of the people of the earth is a religiousness that has confused the universal consciousness with this religious notion of God. The universal consciousness is a neutral, positive entity. It builds universes as a part of its own evolution. The universe that we live in is the material manifestation of the wisdom of the universal consciousness. And this universal consciousness radiates love. It has radiated love since the beginning of time, but it doesn't take your responsibility away. We here on the earth are responsible for everything we do, everything we say, and everything that we think. Now, one of the things that the people of the earth have to start coming to grips with is the real story of our history, which is very strange indeed. And there are some very good researchers that are starting to look at the true history of Earth. And some of these researchers in this next clip are looking at the ancient Peru link between the elongated skulls and the megaliths that exist around the Earth. Now, there's some quiet sections in this clip, but just keep listening. It's very interesting. I guess we have a quiet section here at the beginning. I hope you had the chance to listen to the megalithic roundtable that I did with Barbara DeLong and Ahmad Painter, as well as Kosal. We talked about, and Keith Hunter, of course. We
so
talked
once
about,
again, on the trail of the elongated skulls, elongated headed people, and their relationship to megalithic structures. This person was from the Wadi culture. They were the great, powerful people prior to the Inca in the highlands. And as we have seen in the past, those of you who've seen my videos, where you find a great culture whose name we know, such as the Inca, or the Wadi in this case, we also find these people as well, or this phenomenon, which is called cranial deformation. So it's in places where we find these that we also find great works of architecture and engineering. These, of course, or I shouldn't say of course, but these have not been carbon dated. And so we don't know how old they are, but they probably are older than the Wadi culture. And like with the Paracas people on the coast, with the largest elongated skulls, and amongst the Inca, we find this phenomenon, which is trepanation, or trephination. And this is surgery done in the distant past. And in a high percentage of the cases, the individual survived the operation. Some estimates are at least 60%.
The man you hear talking there is...
And where you find the elongated skulls, as I said, you find engineering works, often in stone, at least in the highlands where you have stone, or on the coast, adobe, pyramids, or great structures. And this is in the Ayacucho area where we find these aqueducts. Now, this is a volcanic stone. Of what hardness, I don't know. But you can see they've clearly been shaped. The common belief is that they were part of a water movement system. And we'll see other examples when we go outside the museum. And then this central character. And you can see, looks kind of Egyptian, whether that's the case or not, but you can see he or she was also part of this presumed water system. Could have been a fountain.
The speaker here is Brian Forrester. He's a very interesting researcher into these megalithic structures.
The road that leads from Paracas on the coast to Cusco in the highlands goes through where I am right now. And it's no mystery to me that here we find masterful engineering works and also elongated skulls. Next we'll go outside.
So he's left the inside of the museum and now they're going outside. You can see, I think they're near the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and some of these very other large megalithic structures. So he's on the outside now and he's showing this, he's panning this camera around. And it's really an interesting video to watch. Anyway, the fellow's name is Brian Forrester, I believe, and perhaps I'll be able to get him as a guest someday. But he's made a link between the megalithic structures of Egypt and these elongated skulls. And I wonder if these elongated skulls belong to the people from Orion that were here. Remember, the Meyer material says the architects of the Great Pyramid.
And again, Wadi period walls, and then all of a sudden there's this. They call it the cave, which makes sense, but who in God's name made this?
Anyway, there's some big gaps in this clip, and he's panning around with this camera as he's, you know, looking at some of these megalithic structures and monolithic structures that are around.
Again, clearly, this was once sealed up.
The thing he's looking at now is this, it's hard to describe. It's a big rectangular.
A really simple guess would be that this was for collecting water, because there seems to be a chamber underneath it. Mm-hmm. But it can't be the same people who made the walls. You notice that's broken. Somebody probably smashed it through it, thinking gold or something was hiding. Same thing with the front. This is broken off. This piece is broken off. You see, these two would have slid together and fit together quite nicely. Now, if it was for water storage by some megalithic culture, water could come through this hole here, but what would they have made the actual draining system, or, you know, collection system out of? And that one's been recycled from an earlier function, because the interior is quite inferior to the interior of this. And another one in behind here. It's got very nice fitting stones, interlock.
There are many mysteries associated with the Great Pyramid.
When you look down to the surface, as if you were looking at a tabletop. It's not perfectly flat. I stupidly did not bring my measuring instruments with me because I didn't think we'd find this today. And looking down the line here, looks pretty, quite straight, as with this one.
Anyway, that clip was of a researcher. His name is Brian Forster. Very interesting guy. And it started out where he was in a museum near the Great Pyramid in Egypt. And in this museum are these elongated skulls, these very large skulls. Some of them have drill holes in them, where some kind of brain surgery was done. I wonder if in the ancient past they had something like the Google implant. Who knows? It's hard to say. And then Brian, he walks outside. He's panning around. He's showing you the Great Pyramid off in the distance. He's also showing you the Sphinx. And then there is these other mysterious, for lack of a better word, almost underground cubicle boxes. I don't know what they stored in those areas. It's really hard to tell. Anyway, this is just part of trying to piece together our history, which is such a strange and mysterious thing, because the Mayer material tells us that the original settlers of the earth were extraterrestrial humans. The first leader, they say, came here about 150,000 years ago. His name was Pelagon. Pelagon was a Ishwish, a king of wisdom. He was living in what they call creational wisdom, which is the fifth stage of human development. And the people of the earth, the native earth humans, who at that time were called Evas, again confused them with the Creator and called him God. Now, Pelagon was very benevolent. He treated the earth humans very well, the native earth humans, again, who were dark-skinned. He was said that at times he had such great powers of telekinesis that he would be seen floating above the ground. It was also said that the powers of his mind could literally cause plants to grow. And actually, Billy has documented to have some of these very, very strange consciousness-related powers as well, which I think is something that we really all have. And I think as we advance more as a society, that we'll start to see these abilities start to materialize. I want to read a few examples of Billy using these consciousness-related abilities. Here's an example. It says, Mayer wrapped his fingers around the 2-franc piece, a coin the size of an American half dollar. Harold cupped his hands around Meyer's fist. Mayer looked at the fist and suddenly his whole body began to tremble. The table shook, as did Meyer's chair. Several people found themselves suddenly fearing the power that had been unleashed. Harold held on to the shaking fist, but when he looked at Meyer's eyes, what he saw startled him. This is hard to describe, he said later. It was as if you were looking into space through his eyes. For 15 seconds, Mayer shook violently As the coin in his fist controlled him, his eyes grew larger, larger, deeper and deeper. His face was now contorted and drained of all blood. Then he collapsed at the table, said Harold. His hands opened and the coin fell out. It was black. All the people stood up. Billy was gasping as if he were dead. It was phenomenal, and I sat face to face with him. I could see the reaction on his face. I've never seen anything like it. You can't describe this with words. The hot coin had singed the palm of Meyer's hand, causing a blister. When Harold had the coin analyzed, a metallurgist told him that to scorch metal would require a heat of 15,000 degrees or 1,500 degrees. Now, this is incredible. Another evening, the elders and Stephen sat again in the kitchen, listening to similar stories from the people who had seen Meyer do things no one could explain. Meyer had done so many things no one could explain that the stories had begun to sound the same to the elders. Some people had seen him hold a 20-centimeter piece between his thumb and index finger and etch his fingerprints into the metal. Elsie had once seen him take a nail 2 to 3 inches long, stand it on its head on the kitchen table, and then cup his hand on the table about 8 inches away. In a moment, as though drawn by some irresistible force, the nail had started to dance across the table and vibrated all the way into Meyer's motionless hand. Well, these are amazing stories of telekinetic powers that Meyer possesses. Now, remember, there are 7 evolutionary steps to human society. The first is primitive. The second is rational life. Most of us here on the earth are in the stage of rational life. In the third stage, we become an intelligent society. Some of us are moving into the third stage. The Pleiaren are at the fourth and fifth evolutionary stages. The fourth stage is called real life. When we become a quote-unquote real society, we will do amazing things. We'll start to have real space travel. We'll travel from star to star with almost no time passing. We'll use hyperspace and various other techniques to conquer the vast distances of space. We'll build artificial intelligence, which will be organic in nature. Semyase's ship has a central computer, which is an organic brain that has the ability to do telepathy, that can have a conversation with Semyase. It's self-aware. It's sentient. It's a living being with a metallic hull, her ship. The ship that she would come to Hinterschmidruti in was truly a living being. Now, the King of Wisdom at stage 5, what they call Ishwish, has tremendous telekinetic abilities like the ones that we described with Pelagon, the ones we just were reading about Billy. Now, these powers come from the human spirit. The human spirit is a tiny fractal copy of the universal consciousness. It's about the size of the head of a pin. It resides in the center of our brain in the area that controls our eye movement, our seeing. It sends out an energy throughout the body that goes throughout our bodies, kind of like a filigree, kind of like a web. It animates every cell in the body. The human spirit is invulnerable. We have a spirit body. Part of the spirit body is something called the gemut. The gemut controls the thoughts and feelings associated with our spirit, which are neutral, positive in nature. Now, one of the spiritual processes in the spirit is what Billy refers to as Empfinden in the German. The Empfinden is the process of perceiving that love of the universal consciousness. The Gemut supplies the psyche with these psychic swinging waves from the realm of electromagnetic life energy. These psychic swinging waves are some of the power, the mechanism, the incredible power of our thoughts. I just talked about a couple examples of the incredible power of the human mind. And the reason it's so powerful is because it really acts as kind of a channel to the universal consciousness. This power, it streams, the impetus for our thoughts streams from the universe itself. In the book, The Psyche, it's either The Psyche or The Mind of Thoughts, I forget which, it says that our thoughts will outlast us. And if you think about that, it's true, especially the greater the thinker you are, because we still have the writings of Plato, Aristotle. We still have the thoughts from people like Tesla, from Einstein. The thoughts of these geniuses outlived their own bodies. And that's the tremendous might of our thoughts. Now, the human spirit will also last longer than your body. It comes out of the body at death, and it goes in the spiritual realm, and the universal consciousness will take your memories, place them in the storage banks, where they become, it's kind of like an organization, like a mosaic. And then at the appropriate time, your human spirit will be placed back into an embryo, the body of a child, and the incredible wisdom of your predecessor personalities is placed into the psyche of the child. A new consciousness is created, and your human spirit is placed into the midbrain of that child. And the energy from your human spirit permeates every cell of that little embryo, and human life comes back in. And the process of consciousness evolution starts to take place in that little child again. And just like the seed sprouts in the spring into a plant, that human spirit then goes through the whole process of maturing via this natural growth process again. Now, as the child grows up and matures, he will get impulses from the storage banks and inspiration from the predecessor personalities. And that way is the way wisdom builds on wisdom, And remember, wisdom is a kind of knowledge which produces energy. And the human spirit is an invention of the creation that helps it evolve to the next level. And, you know, we've talked about the connection of all things in the creation and the way we should be able to sense the radiating love of creation and can sense this connection that all things have together. One of the interesting ways to learn about this connection that all things have together is the study of the rainforest. And I'm going to play, this is a little bit out of sequence, but this is a very, very interesting clip that talks about the canopy beneath the rainforest.
As the cool air blows in off the ocean, humidity builds over the forest. The air is heavy with condensation, culminating in the spectacular and frequent downpours that give these magnificent regions their name, rainfall. There's a quiet still as the brooding clouds draw near. The first droplets of rain fall, a teasing prelude to the approaching downpour. Rain falls in vast quantities in the forest, with millions of liters pouring down each day. It falls in greater quantities than in any other environment on Earth. The plants will only absorb about one quarter of the rainfall. The rest will soak into the soil, flow into the streams, or simply evaporate into the air, creating the humid rainforest environment. Long after the rain has stopped, drops of water continue to fall from the leaves and branches of the canopy, eventually trickling to the forest floor. Groundwater continues to flow, freshly joining myriad streams that weave through the forest. For some trees, this can prove disastrous. Having grown so tall in the desperate quest for sunlight, many trees lack the root structure to stay upright in the softened ground. It can be a dangerous world, where each day is a battle for survival. But with each drop of rain, the canopy is opened to new light. New plant life is given its chance to strive for the top. Early in the new day, we find the rufous fantail. This mystical and rarely seen bird uses a spider's cobweb to stitch her nest together. She has scouted the forest for small twigs and fine grasses that will enable her nest to withstand the harshest of weather conditions. The multicolored king parrot. This magnificent bird eagerly feasts on sweet berries, taking advantage of the morning light. The rainforest is home to many amazing wonders, like this giant fungus. It spreads its spores by releasing them as a fine powder into the morning air. This beautiful landscape provides all the essentials for raising a family. The rufous fantail takes every precaution to keep her eggs from harm. She is an alert mother and guards her eggs jealously through the long incubation. Lush moss.
Rivers, lakes, streams, the earth, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time, which involves many, many lifetimes. And death is just an opportunity for a rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And many of these creatures, Billy calls them Weisenheiten, are connected together by psychic vibrations, and they communicate with one another. And you can hear the crickets and the cicadas and the birds and the trees, and all of these things are part of the rainforest that we just listened to that little clip in. Now, Semyase said that your ancient philosophers said that everything is within the human. The human is the microcosm within the macrocosm. And we see in nature repeating patterns like the electron swinging around the nucleus in our bodies. All of these atoms in the galaxy, in the solar system, we see planets rotating around stars. In our circulatory system, we see the branching structure associated with our veins and capillaries. We see the branching structure in the trees, and we see the spiral shape in the shell and the spirals in the formation of the galactic arms. And here's a short clip. I'll play just part of this that talks about a spiral galaxy with a secret.
The NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope, with a little help from an amateur astronomer, has produced one of the best views yet of nearby galaxy Messier 106, a striking spiral galaxy with a number of secrets. Located a little over 20 million light-years away, practically a neighbor by cosmic standards, Messier 106 is one of the brightest and nearest spiral galaxies to our Milky Way. Although it may not look particularly unique, some of its features have baffled astronomers for years. Messier 106 has a supermassive black hole at its center. Although this is true for most galaxies, this black hole is particularly active and hungry, gobbling up nearby material at a startling rate. This huge black hole's bottomless appetite is behind much of the galaxy's unusual behavior. Messier 106 appears to be emitting powerful radiation from its center, something we do not see with our Milky Way. This is caused by the very active black hole at the galaxy's center, which violently drags gas and dust inwards. This material heats up, emitting bright microwave and X-ray radiation as it does so. However, this emission is not the most intriguing feature of this spiral galaxy. This image shows the galaxy's other not-so-hidden secret. Alongside its two regular, star-packed spiral arms, it appears to have two more, made out of hot, glowing gas.
Anyway, the spiral galaxy has these spiraling arms that spiral in much the way a seashell spirals. And ASCII kind of discusses some of these higher concepts in something called ASCII's Explanations. Let's listen to a bit of this clip.
English ASCII 1. Creation is the foundation of life and of being. 2. We fulfill our mission in the strength of creation, which is not only cosmic but universal significance, because creation is life and creation is being. 3. And to fulfill our mission, we have to neutralize the space-time connection barrier between our near universes, so that we can achieve a harmonious passage through without damage to ships and universes. 4. Because our homeworld lies in the Dao universe, in the Aiken system, in a system foreign to you Earth humans, of a universe just as foreign to you, of which several surround the universe known to you, on the seventh outer belt. 5. Many of these universes lie in other time planes, and in, for you, expanses of utter foreignness. 6. Our universe is a parallel sister universe to yours, respectively a twin universe, and, calculated according to your concepts, it lies in a similar plane. 7. The difference between your time and ours is only very slight. 8. The reason for our coming into this, your Dern universe, lies in earlier times, that are calculated in several centuries, and, indeed, in the urge to explore, and in the fulfillment of an obligation of our race, who, from the earliest times, came from your Dern universe. 9. Made possible through technical developments, an ancient universe barrier was opened again between our universe and your universe, that guaranteed us the entrance into your time, after which the knowledge about it, lost many thousands of years ago, was worked out again. 10. Since then we again explored the expanses of your universe and, several centuries ago, discovered this solar system and, therewith, this world, whose inhabitants show a very old connection with the Pleiadians, as you name them for certain reasons, and in which we also are involved, also in the form of that which pertains to a mission. 11. To be precise, the centuries, by your time reckoning, line up together to 33, during which we were again able to travel and explore your universe. 12. Through our incessant explorations we again found this world, as well as also our original homeland, and the very distant descendants of those who, from the earliest time, were the responsible ones who were relevant to the human life of this world, because a portion of the humans of the earth were not born here. 13. Many are descendants of those who came out of the expanse of outer space, and indeed from that space that you name Lyra and Vega with the Eye of God, the Ring Nebula.
Anyway, we started today's shows out talking about what they refer to as the Eye of God or the Ring Nebula. I hope you've enjoyed the shows we've done this afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow. We've got a lot of time for the next few days to talk about the Meyer case. Have a good evening.